Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hello, listeners. Thanks for joining the Global Marketing Podcast today. Today, I'm very excited to introduce Davida Ginter. So welcome. You have a fascinating, extremely global outlook and experience. So I think we're going to get interesting discussions.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you for the invitation. I'm honored to be here and participate in this conversation.
Oh, good. Well, I'm really looking forward to it. So you are the co-founder and CEO of Enkindle Global, which focuses on helping people and organizations in preventing burnout and cultivating well-being around the world. So it's not just an American thing. You're seeing this all over the place. And before we deep dive into that more, but I wanted to give a little bit on your, more on your background. You're the author of the book, Burning Out Won't Get There. You're the founder of Be the Change Sustainability Center, which facilitates processes with leaders who make a true impact to create a better society. And you've got your bachelor's in sociology and anthropology. So you actually studied something that you've gotten into. So tell me more about Enkindle Global so we kind of frame the conversation today.
Enkindle Global was born actually from an idea to hold a global event. Leaders for people who care about mobilizing social change and want to remain well and thrive while they do it. So the purpose of the event was to support those leaders and change makers in burnout prevention. That was the initial intention. This is how the idea started. That happened after I finished writing my book about burnout. We had all this knowledge gathered. We really wanted to do something practical with it. But as we start rolling, the idea about the event, the global event, the big one, never happened. And what we did is that we broke it into a series of events, and we started just a big organization, a global one, that its entire purpose is to support leaders and then organizations in this journey of mobilizing change while not burning out, while maintaining well-being, while building emotional resilience. And my team is an international one. We are located in different countries, different continents. We see it as a global mission because it was never framed around the local context.
So you decide to start this symposium or forum, conference. What did you call it?
It was an event.
An event. Okay, yeah. You were going to have an event about social change. And how did the burnout get wrapped into that? Because they don't go hand normally.
But that's exactly the thing. My journey with burnout prevention started because I'm coming from the field of leading social change for almost a decade now. This is what I do. I help leaders actualize their vision around social change. How do they lead this? And while doing that work, I noticed so many of my colleagues and leaders I've been working with, my fellow changemakers, I noticed so many of them getting burnt out in that process. This is how my journey started. I got really curious to know, to explore more, why do changemakers burn out in this process? How come sustainability practitioners forget to sustain themselves? And this is the context.
When you talk about social change, sustainability. What specific areas were your leaders working on?
It could be any kind of process that's meant to contribute to a better society, a better environment. It could be people who lead, who initiate and lead environmental projects or social projects. And usually, and that's really interesting to me, those go together. We easily notice that when we want to improve our surroundings, then we also help the people and vice versa.
So when I think about people who do that, environmental change and society change and social change, I think of them as young, energetic, and passionate. Was that the kind of people you were seeing burn out, or was it different?
Yes, many of them are exactly as you described. Although I think the age doesn't play a big role here, so we can see people from all different age groups. It's about that passion, that commitment to create social change. But it's the same passion and inner fire that drives you to do what you do. It's the same fire and passion that could lead you to burnout if you don't, set those self boundaries, the self care, the personal sustainability.
Yes. So it's the yin and the yang, the good and the bad. It's the passion. If it's not kept in check, it leads to burnout. And this is something you were seeing over and over again.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So now you see this happening when the event planning is starting and you're going into it and you say, I'm going to start a global company that talks about burnout. Is there certain cultures that tend to it more, or certain people, or what were you targeting?
That was one of the questions I kept asking myself and then other people. Is it different from one region to another, from one country to another, from one culture to another? And after holding dozens of formal interviews and then hundreds probably of informal conversations, my main realizations, it's all presented in the book, is that even though some reasons could for burnout, some causes of burnout could differ from one place to another, from one country or culture to another, the signs and the expression of burnout are usually the same. So it could be, for example, that people in the United States are getting burnt out because they not only work tons of hours because they want to prove themselves, it's also about their sense of worth. As I'm just quoting people that have shared this with me, that they correlate worth, self-worth, with how much time and effort they put in the work, which could lead to burnout when you work so many hours invested and you never stop to take a break because you feel lazy and egoistic when you do that. While in other cultures, we see different causes of burnout.
I can completely understand that. And I'm pretty in tune with trying to stay healthy and emotionally healthy. But I've been working too much, particularly now. Yeah.
Okay. I think it's very common, exactly. But when we look, for example, at Japan.
Yes.
Okay. How many hours they work or how much they feel that they can't stop for work, it's something else. It's the norm to bottle in the struggles and challenges and almost never to openly share what's really going on internally. And when you don't feel comfortable to express your struggles, your stressors, your challenges, and when it's all kept inside, the stress just gets bigger and bigger and chronic, and then it leads to burnout. But eventually...
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So here in the United States, if you ask how somebody is doing, they'll say, I'm so busy. I mean, that's such a common, I'm so busy. Whereas in Japan, you'd never hear that.
You will not hear that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But both will lead to a burnout.
Both lead to burnout, and I've heard different stories from South America, and obviously different from Australia. So, like I said, it could be different in the sense of the causes and the culture. But at the end, it's still burnout. People are still reacting the same. They are still emotionally and physically exhausted. They still will eventually, when they burnt out, feel negative and cynical and feel emotionally distanced from their work or their colleagues or their mission, right? So at the end, burnout feels the same. I've talked to so many people who said, eventually we stayed in bed for 2 months because we couldn't function anymore. And that's global. That's a global description.
And so what's going on right now this year as, you know, we've been going through COVID? Are you seeing more burnout, or what's the conversation with that?
Interesting. We see a change in the main causes. So we still see the same. It's too early to measure and have accurate data, of course. But what we can see is rise in data of stress and anxiety. We can see that, we can track that by the amount of calls and texts received in emergency and hotlines. People are reporting they are more stressed, more anxious. And burnout is chronic stress that has not been managed well. This is what leads to burnout, chronic stress.
Oh.
But what can we point out already is that the causes have been changed a bit. So for example, if before, like I said, it was some workload, some disengagement, some lack of trust, different causes. Now we see something else. For example, how boundaries between personal life and work have been dissolved. Because, you know, we work from home. Can we determine when it's personal life and when it's work? When the kids can come in and in Japan, when, oh no, stay outside, I'm talking. You see what I mean? So we have this constant tension, and that's a question. Can we manage in a healthy way that's the tension? How do we approach that? So that's one big sign. And of course, uncertainty. We keep talking about uncertainty in the context of COVID.
Right.
And that leads to more stress. So if we know how to manage that, that's not a problem. Stress by itself, it's not a negative thing. But if you can't manage, if you can't face this uncertainty, then it's growing stress and anxiety leads to burnout.
So you're in Tel Aviv right now, right?
I'm a little up north from Tel Aviv. I live in the northern part of Israel.
Okay, so you're in Israel. So that's a very multicultural area. You're now working globally. What was your first exposure to another language or culture? We're gonna jump away from your company for a minute, and we'll come back.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we grew up here hearing Arabic all the time. I can't speak fluent Arabic, but I can understand some. We borrowed a lot of Arabic words, and we use them daily. Integrated into Hebrew. Even without noticing. So that's one part. And I think, the first time I actually started to use the second language, which is English, obviously, was when I traveled to Australia and New Zealand for several months in my early 20s. But then the biggest experience of hearing using another language was when I was living abroad in Sweden for a year, when I've taken my master's degree.
Okay. So here you are in your early 20s, you go off to Australia and New Zealand, and then you go off to Sweden for your master's. Was that done in English or in Swedish?
Yes. I can speak a lot Swedish. It was done in English. The program was held in English. It was an international program. And that was my biggest fear, really, to be honest. We went away for a year. to do a master's degree while having two young kids. One of them was, my baby was 6 months years old.
Oh my gosh.
And that was not what was frightening me. It was the English. How will I do a master's degree in English? How will I write an entire thesis in English? How will I present, you know, stand and defend my thesis, make presentations in English? I almost didn't go because of that fear. yeah.
Wow. Okay. So your number one fear of going to school internationally, which is a common fear for people doing business internationally, is I don't know the language. So you land there and you go and you've got young kids at home. How did you manage through the language and juggling all that? Let's start with the language.
The language, what I realized, it was obviously a mental barrier. My English was good enough to get by, at least at the beginning. And then, of course, it was improved during that year. The more you write, the more you speak and communicate in any language, I would guess, the more you feel confident with that. So, yeah, I probably made tons of mistakes. But I realized, hey, we are a group of 50 international students. I'm not the only one making mistakes in English. And that has been accepted so warmly and kindly. So I felt okay with that. And we just learned as we go. About the juggling, well, I went with my husband. He took care of the kids. That worked well. It was a lot of support there. I had a strong support system. So that felt right.
Oh, that's wonderful. Good for you. That's such a great story to hear. So you finish up from graduate school. And then you head on to where?
Well, when I finished that master's program in Sweden, I went back to Israel. I went back to Israel, gave birth to my third child. And while I was taking my baby in the stroller, I suddenly knew what I want to do, because when I came back, I had all these different thoughts. What will I do with all that knowledge that I gained? I went to study leadership for sustainability. That was the program. And while I was traveling with the stroller, suddenly I had this idea, this clarity. What do I want to do with it? And that led to my projects, ongoing projects around sustainability, around leadership, and then eventually around burnout prevention.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you knew you wanted to get into leadership in sustainability, but getting in there, you could really see that there was a problem with burnout.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's when you started. When did you start your company?
In Kendall Global, the current company is relatively young. It's almost 2 years old. Mm-hmm. And we've been very, very fortunate to have such a collaborative and committed team. We work remotely because it's an international team. We work remotely from day one. So in that sense, this is how we work. We have been working from the beginning.
Okay. And so when you say it's a remote team and virtual, you're operating in four countries.
Yes,
correct. Where are you? So why don't you tell us where you are?
So myself, as I said, I'm located in Israel, and I travel for work a few times a year. That, of course, relevant to pre-COVID times, but usually I travel for work several times a year. My teammates are located in Sweden, in Denmark, and in Oregon, United States.
Okay. And then, and so you're doing most of your business in English?
Yes. Well, when I facilitate here in Israel, it's the client's, the company's choice if they want me to facilitate a process in English or Hebrew. And when my colleague is working locally in Sweden, of course, they can choose to be taught in Swedish, but generally the vast majority of our work is being held in English. We post and publish in English. This is our main language of communication, absolutely.
Okay. And so talk to me about what language struggles you run into.
I think there's always this question of the cultural local context. Sometimes we have these funny discussions. One of us think, oh, we found a great word, great wording for a message. And the other one said, no, Swedes won't get it. Norwegian won't get it. And the American said, well, it sounds perfect to me. And the other one says, well, no, here in the European context, just it's not working. So this is one interesting part that we just need to figure out terminology that works for different contexts and different cultures.
Okay.
And yeah, I would say this is the main challenge. Mm-hmm.
Right. So you think that in English will be fine, you can do it, but you spend a long time coming up with messages that can work across all the cultures.
Yes, and I think the question is, I don't know if we spend a lot of time, sometimes we just go and test and try, right? But I think the main question here is, how will they understand? So we're trying to say something that is very, could be, for example, clear to Americans. Will that be translated the same in the European context? I mean, we can translate word by word. That doesn't mean that it works in that context, right? Mm-hmm. We see things differently. We just had a conversation about it yesterday. Just yesterday, live example from our team call.
Oh, good.
Our teammate from Oregon, she phrased something like, preventing burnout and keeping you something like ahead of the curve.
Ah.
It sounded perfect for her. I thought, okay, that's a nice business context. And one of our Swedish team members said, what do you mean by that? So we started explaining, saying, no, I know the expression, but no one here in Sweden could relate. That's not a good hook in Sweden to say stay ahead of the curve. They don't care about this. I don't know if she's right or not. We laughed a lot about it. But these are the sort of dialogues that we sometimes have. Would it work here, there? What should we do with it to adjust, to customize the terminology to different contexts that we work in?
Wow. Okay. So when you're is this a program? So you develop programs that then can be launched in all the different countries that you're operating in, right?
Yes, exactly. Those are programs and strategic processes so we can step in into organization. It doesn't matter if it's a business organization or an NGO, and help them by facilitating this process with their Get Them Through programs so they are well equipped even after we are gone, so they can keep doing that work.
Okay. That all focuses on it. So every time you go into a new, launch it into a new country or a new business, you have to review the whole thing to make sure people understand it, even though they speak English and it's being presented in English.
Yeah, it's a question of need. I said exactly a year ago, last September, I sat in a Norwegian office with a wonderful leader, change makers involved in environmental processes worldwide. And we're sitting there. It's a lovely and nice conversation. And I tell him about our activities. He smiles through the entire time. And then in the end, he said, we don't have this problem in Norway. And we know for a fact that burnout happens everywhere, or almost everywhere. But I understood my mistake in the sense that sometimes people don't get it in their context.
Yeah.
It's very, very different from one place to another.
So I had this interesting conversation on one of the podcasts where he was talking about he and his wife spoke French. And no, it was Spanish. It was Spanish. And when he and his wife talked about emotional stuff, they spoke in Spanish. But when they spoke, and they live in the United States, but when they spoke about logistics and kids, they spoke in English because that's the world that they lived in and grew up in. So now you're talking about burnout, which is a very emotional thing, but you're doing it in a lot of people's second language. Do you ever think about doing it in their native language when you run across somebody like that that says, yeah, we don't have that here?
On one hand, I totally see the need that you are referring to. People will most likely feel more comfortable, to express themselves on the emotional level in their mother tongue. That makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, first, it will require us to train local facilitators, which could be a long-term ambition, of course, but at the moment, we are such a young organization, we're not there yet. Secondly, I keep thinking that there's part of me who wants to maintain that unity of language. And the reason for that is I love the idea of diversity that happens within a group. So sometimes we are able to bring people from different countries and different cultures to sit together. For example, in a workshop or, like I said, an event or something like that. So it's not always processes for organizations. And when that happens, and the only way for those people to communicate and understand each other is in English, that's the most, I don't know if it's the most spoken language in the world, you would tell me better, you know it better than me, but it's definitely...
It's not Spanish and Chinese, right?
It's not, probably Spanish and Chinese, I figured out, but usually when we bring people from different countries, that was my intention, English seemed like the perfect solution for everyone to understand one another and communicate openly. And that means that, yes, sometimes we need a minute to articulate what we feel, right? Mm-hmm. But it still feels better to have this diversity, you know, different people coming together for this circle or workshop, whatever it is that we are holding at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's worth it, the moment of hesitation, how do I pronounce it? And we encourage those moments of silence or those moments of let's ask for a minute. I myself can sit there with the group and ask for a minute, how do you say this word? I'm not embarrassed anymore like I used to be before. I'm not, you know, I don't feel awkward to say I don't know how to pronounce a word or what it's meaning. And I want to encourage the participants to do the same, because language should not be a barrier here, especially if we want to express our emotions.
So I agree with you, because I think diversity adds so much, that bringing it together, people have different perspectives and what burnout looks like across culture, and then realizing that we're all struggling with the same thing, even though it may show differently. So on one hand, it's really good. On the other hand, I wonder, you know, like I speak a little Spanish, I can travel with it. I certainly don't do the language work here. And if I were to go into a situation where I'd be learning about something very emotional, I would think I would miss something. So have you ever thought about, and I understand when you're a small company doing it in language, you've got to translate it, you've got to find the local facilitator. So that's a longer term vision. So I was happy to hear that. And then do you ever think about having interpreters to make sure that people really get the material?
I think it's a wonderful idea. It's something that we haven't tested yet. The only one similar thing that we did, we had a graphic harvester. And that was wonderful because she could capture everything said in a graphic way while the conversation was going. Yeah, she did an amazing job, and it really lifted the level and energy of the conversation. Yet, of course, everyone understands graphic language. Of course, I believe it's not the same as people can, like I said before, communicate in their native language and speak their hearts. So I think it's an interesting idea. We definitely consider different options there.
Yeah. Curious if you had ever thought about it, you know, just all the different options that would be out there to facilitate conversations that are so interesting like this. Let's jump into your marketing. So you've had this company for 2 years. You've got something that's definitely needed globally. What do you do for marketing to bring in new business?
Technically, we just work a lot with or through LinkedIn to put a lot of value out there. We give, we share, and then people or organizations or leaders are coming. They see the need, they consume obviously this value, and then if they want to proceed, we go to the phase of actually facilitating a training or process for them. In terms of the content itself, as I said, one of it is share a lot of value, and the other is to open a lot of what I love to call meaningful or even bold conversations around burnout. So the more we see the need to speak about burnout, how common it is, we don't only show data. Because it's good, but it's not always a good emotional hook. We mainly want to engage people in this conversation. So this is what we do a lot also as a marketing strategy. We just engage people in those conversations in different ways. It could be online, now it's online, online circles or webinars. I'm not a big fan of webinars because we always love to do it in a participatory way, very, very interactive.
Right.
So we bring people into the conversation, we start something there, we share a lot of value, and people are starting to get that. It takes time, but they start seeing the value in communicate, in connect around this topic, connect with other people who are going through something similar, understand that burnout is not a given and we can actually do something about it, prevent it on time, obviously, manage it as we go. So this is at the core of our marketing strategy, to show rather than tell.
Okay, and so you do a lot of content through LinkedIn is how you're making a lot of your connections. Right. Yeah, so outbound content, like you're pushing it out, or are you also a lot of content to bring in inbound leads, but then are you also targeting people that you're reaching out to, or you're mostly putting content out and people will self-select?
Mostly putting content. I don't do a lot of targeted reach out for different reasons. We have been busy serving people so far, so there wasn't a big need for that until now. We'll see what will happen next, but just putting content has helped a lot with visibility of our mission and company.
And you're doing that all in English?
Yes. Well, in LinkedIn, all in English. When I do other channels for which could be more local, it could be in Hebrew in my case. But that's a very small percentage of our strategy for reach out.
And what countries do you think have you done the most business in?
It was definitely Norway, Sweden, and the United States, and Israel, where I'm located. These are the four main countries that we have been working in or with organizations that are located in.
Okay, so that's where you have a partner, that you have a presence in. And so,
kind of. Mm-hmm.
And so are you, is it through your networks that you're getting, or is it really through LinkedIn? Because you have a presence in each of those countries.
Yeah, so it's both. And what mainly is actually is relationships built over time. Since I've studied in Scandinavia, some connections remain there and keep developed them over the years. So when I was started to be invited, for example, to conferences to speak at a conference in Oslo, that led to other business connections in Norway. And from there to Sweden, I've studied in Karlskrona, but then I found myself going to Gothenburg and Stockholm and just different locations. So that to say that, yeah, some of it is putting content and marketing. A lot of it is actually in-person relationships that both sites have put a lot of time and effort to build those collaborations over time.
Okay. All right. And so what's your plans for expanding the business?
So many. I was just thinking that in an ironic way, in an ideal world, I would be out of work because if there isn't burnout and we have succeeded in our mission, I can move on to the next mission. Unfortunately, it will take time to get to the point where people really get the idea of maintaining well-being and emotional resilience on a regular basis, which means that we still suffer from high levels of stress, anxiety, and of course burnout, which is the result. So we have different aspirations and goals within our vision. We want to expand our reach out. We want to go to other regions. It's not, like I said, it's a global phenomenon. So we really want to, help people in different places. We had, for example, this idea to start local branches or maybe ambassadors to carry that mission, ambassadors and local leaders. It has to be a leadership role. It has to be inner commitment to do something like that, to support people in burnout prevention, right? I mean, you need to be passionate about this mission as well. So this is part of our vision. I'm already drafting my second book that will be related in some way. We want to increase the impact.
Yes. And when you talk about ambassadors or local leaders, do you have companies defined that you'd like to go to or open?
Yeah, nothing specific. Again, we are building relationships for the long term. I have contacts in different places, but it's some of those connections are not mature yet to actually build something sustainable. Mm-hmm. But that just means that we have more work to do, and that's exactly how the journey is supposed to be. So
right. Yeah, no, what I was curious about is the ambassadors and the local leaders and the newer relationships. Are they still in countries that speak English?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I put the question. No, not at all. This is, for me, not a criteria. I would love to, set my foot in Asia. I mean, I'm physically in Asia. I'm talking about the Far East, China, Japan, Vietnam. I have fellow change makers in Vietnam that I'm sure will do a fantastic job in that field, and it just takes time to build those. So it's definitely not about English speaking countries. That's for us not, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So this is an interesting point that we got to in the interview. So right now, you're very focused on English and creating materials that will work across English-speaking countries. And that's a very American view. Well, I'm only going to go into countries that can speak English because I've got this fear of the language. And so for me, it was interesting to hear you go off and master another language and culture, but still be functioning only in English. But your longer term vision is to go into countries where it wouldn't be done in English. So you don't have that fear of language anymore and know that will be part of growth. Am I catching that right?
Yes, I think you are, because for me, you know, I use English daily now. So I would definitely say that the fear is gone. Yes.
Right.
But as I said, the language should not be a barrier. So for me, if I can, you know, scale up the impact and go to any region basically that wants to, that is committed to this mission, then why not? And this is for me really not the issue. If they speak English, we'll find the solutions. It will take time to craft the right solution for that challenge, but I see it as a challenge, as an opportunity, and not as a problem at all.
Okay, so say you get a call from a big company in Japan who says, we want you to come do it now. How would you go about doing that?
That is actually quite an easy one. First thing I get on the phone with her. The lovely thing about going to an international program is that you make friends from all over the world, and also the alumni, not necessarily those in my cohort. And you know you have, it was such a lovely, warm program that we see them as family members, even if we haven't seen each other for years. So I know I can pick up the phone now to my friend, colleague in Japan, and start by that. What would you advise me to do? Who should I speak with? How should we start something like that? And this is exactly how I would do that, yeah.
Okay, so you've got a connection in Japan that you could reach out to get help from on how to launch a program there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so what about...
But I can, new places, yeah.
Yeah, and so...
What about new places?
Do you feel like you had, so say you didn't know anybody in a country that, you know, like say it was China and you didn't know anybody. How would you go about doing that?
So that happened to me when I've written the book. I wanted to interview people from different places in the world, and I didn't know anyone from, for example, from Africa. Mm-hmm. Or from South America. So I just started through the network and through mutual connections until I reached someone. I reached a wonderful lady in Kenya. I politely approached her through mutual introduction. I explained my purpose. And she was lovely. We got on a call. I sent her the book afterwards. And so it taught me that even if I, you know, go to a new land, for me, it's always, especially today with social media, it's always possible to have someone who can, you know, introduce you and go from there and go from the other, from one person to another, until you find someone you can actually collaborate with on some level.
So if you were going to make a recommendation to a company in the U.S. that wanted to go international, what would you recommend for them? How to start?
If it's possible, I would recommend travel there. Schedule some coffee meetings with key actors in the field that you want to operate in.
Mm-hmm.
So get to know these people in advance online. If it's possible, go there physically. Spend, I don't know, a week, couple of weeks there, meeting those people. Feel the place, hear about the local context, you know, experience that. You'll probably learn much more in those 2 weeks while sitting with those people from your field than any online reading that you would do. And I would say just start with making a fabulous list of questions, which is about what do you need to know? What I don't know that I don't know, right?
Right. Right. That's an excellent idea. So you can narrow down the countries and then use your network to find people to introduce you to the people that you want to go meet in person. Yeah. All right. So let's switch. Oh, yeah. No, some other cultural questions. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen in all the cross-cultural or cross-country business that you've seen?
Wow, good question. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if there was something. Well, obviously there's a lot, because of cultural differences, there's a lot of sensitivity in different areas. For us, for example, even as a team, it took us a while. We've been very sensitive, so I think we managed that quite well. But it took us a while to understand the different mindsets, for example, about work or working hours. If for some people in some countries, that's totally legit to work on the weekends or evenings. For other people in other countries, no, working after 5 p.m., this is my private time, personal time. Working on the weekend, that you know. So we had to be very, very sensitive about respecting everyone's needs, which arrive from cultural differences. It will not insult, for example, some people in some countries to ask them to meet on a Saturday, on a Sunday. They can say no, but they will not see it as a personal insult. While with others, it will be, you're invading my private time, actually. And now I get it. I totally respect it. And I've learned a lot from these cultures and those people about respecting this personal space and time.
So what countries are tend to work nights and weekends, and what countries, you know, the cultures say? Yeah. Private time.
This is my personal observation, so you know, don't use it against me, but my personal observation is that, for example, we Israelis as well as Americans are willing to work evenings, weekends, and nights, by the way, if needed. Uh-huh. While in Scandinavia, and specifically in Denmark, they will not work after, say, 5 p.m. unless it's really needed. Weekends are time off unless it's for a retreat or like a seminar or something like that, then it's very acceptable. In Denmark, it's amazing. They have the term, probably, you know, the hygge. Yes. Where they maintain, right? And you know, it's I think, I'm not sure if 4 p.m. or 5 p.m. their pen just drops on the table and that's it. We go home now. And you know what?
Why don't you explain hygge for anybody who's listening?
Hygge, yeah, it's so healthy. I hope we can explain it well. There's a wonderful book that's the title, hygge. It's the approach, the prevalent approach in Denmark of how to live a healthy life, physically and emotionally. Mm-hmm. It could be things like the setting of the room, you know, with the candles, especially in the winter, and a very warm and cozy space. And it could be spending intimate evenings with your friends and family, or being in the outdoors in the summer and enjoy some sports activities. And it's well, what's the big deal? We all do it. No, but they allocate time for that intentionally. That's a big part of their culture and the way they maintain their well-being. I really learned a lot from reading about the hygge and seeing it myself in, you know, personally seeing that experience, and that's just fabulous.
So you would think that in Denmark there's less burnout if they've embrace toga in their culture, but it's probably still there.
It's still there. The numbers actually are a bit lower. Not in Sweden. I'm specifically talking about Denmark. In Sweden, they have a slightly different problem, which relates again to expressing emotions. Yes, in Denmark, actually, they are reporting a very high level of life satisfaction and even happiness.
Yes.
That's interesting. What you say is very interesting. There's a very strong linkage between the two.
So we need to have everybody hygge everywhere.
I'm in.
Yes. That's your passion. Yes. Right. So then off to some personal questions, just on your global experience. What's been your favorite vacation?
Wow, so many. I'll go choose. One of my favorites was when the first time we went with the kids abroad. They were quite young, but we decided it's time. They were four, six, and nine. Mm-hmm. And we went to Finland with them.
Ah, fun.
That was amazing vacation. First of all, they behave well, so we felt comfortable. And what was so nice is that we could hike and be in the outdoors for, I think it was 2 weeks, just, you know, experience nature and just, you know, be there, be present. Us, you know, parents, kids in nature. Finland is a beautiful place to travel if people like doing that. So I think it was mainly the relaxation mode.
Yes.
That I think too.
Yes. For a nice amount of time with just the family. How about a favorite memory of a rewarding cross-cultural experience in work?
I had a very interesting conversation. It was again for the book when I was looking for interviews. I was interviewing a woman named Luazi from Cape Town. And it was really interesting in the sense that she was fully transparent about the frustration that people from her region feel about the way their achievements are recognized or under-recognized in the world. She said to me, this is a powerful quote that I probably never forget. She said to me, you know, we do it out of the passion to lead change, social change, to do good in the world. We do it out of this commitment and passion.
Mm-hmm.
But our efforts and our actions in that field, it feels at the moment that we'll never be as recognized and rewarded as those in the Western world. So if you have an impact entrepreneur from West Europe compared to impact entrepreneur from, say, South Africa, and they will do a very similar initiative, the headlines, the public recognition that the person from the Western world, the entrepreneur from the Western world will receive will be much higher. That was, that's the perspective that Luazi shared with me. And I felt very strongly about it, obviously. I shared with her my frustration living in Israel, knowing that we have Palestinian neighbors that I know individually as people are doing wonderful things that no one in the world knows about them. That's big frustrations. We get the headlines for the conflict, not for the social impact, right?
Right.
So we share those experiences, not in the sense of we're going to complain to each other. We sense those experiences in order to understand how can we lead change, even if a minor one, within what's happening in this issue of differences between how impact is being received in the world. And that was a very powerful cross-cultural exchange of ideas for me.
Right. Right. That is fascinating. I'm going to have to think on that one more, because it is true. In the U.S., we hear a lot about the conflict in Israel and then about apartheid, you know, when still, you know, the problems coming out of that. But, you know, and occasionally I'll hear about a lot of good companies or biotech companies coming out of Israel. But yeah, what's the country known for, and how does the news get lost in there? Huh. Yeah. Yes.
Actually, I think the Palestinians are those who suffer way more from lack of recognition for their social activities. I think Israelis actually do have quite a good name in the sense of entrepreneurship and innovation.
Right.
But if I have a colleague from Bethlehem, from the Palestinian side, who I know is doing beautiful things with children and women for, you know, reducing violence. She has an initiative called the House of Hope. Who knows about it in the world? Who knows about it? I wouldn't know if I was not connected to her through a friend from Norway. You know, get the strange circle, exactly.
Right.
And this is irony. This is frustrating in a sense, but this is something we need to change. I don't want to stay with the frustration. I want to take it into a place of making change happen.
Right, right. All right. Favorite place to do business?
Wow. Walking meeting? Well, favorite place in the world, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would stay with Oslo.
Oslo.
I've done business on a boat in Oslo. I don't feel nothing could be that yet. So that felt right. Yeah.
That must be pretty hugger to do business on a boat in Oslo.
Beautiful. I was freezing, but it was still beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, that's
not freezing. Yeah.
All right. How about your favorite foreign word?
Wow. Favorite foreign word. Sometimes it comes, it's probably from my high school studies of French, but sometimes goes naturally that someone said something and it resonates with me, and I could say exactement.
Exactement. That's excellent. I like that. Exactement.
This is it. Yeah. Exactement.
We all need hugger. Exactement.
Yeah. You said it well.
Well, Davida, this has been wonderful. Where can people find out more about what you do?
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation. So people can find me either in my personal website, davidaginter.com, or in our company website, in kindleglobal.com.
Okay, and can you spell those?
Davida Ginter, davidaginter.com. And in Kindle Global is spelled ENKINDLE Global, GLOBAL .com.
Wonderful. And you're very active on LinkedIn too. So just search your name and you'll come up.
Absolutely. I'm active on LinkedIn. I'm happy to share values and build connections. Just how the two of us met.
I know. That's been wonderful to see your posts and learn about you. And so that's what pushed me to reach out and say, oh, this woman looks interesting to talk to.
Thank you.
I'm so glad. Well, thank you everybody for listening. If you learned something today or you laughed, tell somebody about this podcast. You can find it in all of your favorite places to listen to podcasts. We'll see you next time with our next guest. That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did.
New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.